As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome back to Allocation Disorder. I am Sam Staskel. He is Paul Tenorio, and we have a ratified CBA brought to you this week by the Peter Francis Stracey Law Firm. Because as long as we have a CBA, let's talk about lawyers, Peter Francis Stracey. Paul, your thoughts?
Wow. We're getting real Chicago local with the people that are sponsoring you, Sam. And a real look into how Sam's brain works. You know, sorry. I think that we've gotten to this point now where you and I both feel, I think, a little bit goofy right now just from having covered so many CBA negotiations over the last 12 months. I actually look at the fact that this CBA is going to run for another 7 years as a positive, that I might not have to do this again for a while.
Haven't I told you not to say that? Force majeure is still in there, Paul. They could invoke it again next year in theory.
Yeah, but at that point in time, I'll just let you handle the whole story and I just won't touch it.
At that point in time, I'll be living on an island with no internet access. So, enjoy.
I think we both can look at it and say the owners got exactly what they wanted here, right? They wanted the 2-year extension. It was the most important thing that was on the table, and they got it. And in exchange, the players got what they wanted, which was no pay cut in 2021, and they got a few small givebacks from the owners that, you know, they're not unsubstantial, right?
They're meaningful.
The free agency goes from 24-5 to 24-4 beginning in 2026. They saw some movement in the cap on free agent earnings going up. They saw a little bit of movement in increase in available spending in some of the years of the terms of the CBA. Again, not nothing, but I think you and I can both sit back and say, you know, the owners are coming out of these talks much happier than the players are.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, we wrote an article on this that will hopefully be going up soon as we sit here recording on Monday afternoon. But basically, the union was playing defense in this round of negotiations, right? In a normal CBA, like the one we saw last February, that isn't being negotiated because of a force majeure clause, the union would be pushing for gains, right? And in this case, and as was the case in June when we did this for the, I guess, second time out of three, it's the league that is trying to claw things back, and the union is trying to kind of limit the damage, so to speak. And so they were always going to take some hits. The 2-year one is a substantial hit. That's no joke. You know, we've talked about it a lot on this show, but that pushes it back to almost a year and a half after the end of the 2026 World Cup. So you're way past that World Cup bump. And who knows what the TV deal situation is going to be at that point. Basically, it's just a lot of time for the league to grow without having to come back to the table and give some of that growth to players, right? And Paul, we were just talking about this before the show. The initial CBA last February that was agreed to ran through 2024. It now runs through 2027. They've almost doubled the length of this thing over these last two rounds of modifications. It's really substantial, and a lot of the players in the league now are pretty locked in. I shouldn't say locked in. They're at the league's discretion in terms of gains at this point. You know, the system isn't going to change unless the league and the owners want it to, right? And while that's there's an element of truth to that, even regardless of the length of the CBA, it's even more true now that it's extended through 2027.
And we should say that, you know, the league has historically taken advantage of those moments by putting in discretionary pots of money that they can spend at their disposal. We should note that in the last or two rounds ago of negotiations last February, that the league, or sorry, the union did put in some protections against that. That any discretionary funding that started to come in after 2021 season going into 2022, that they would have to put at least 40% of whatever discretionary funds would have to go in as GAM or salary budget. That's obviously been pushed back along with every other term of the CBA twice now over the life of the CBA. But there are some protections in there to try to give the majority of the player pool at least a piece of the action. But to your point, you know, the owners now are controlling exactly how we're going to see those gains. And I think we should anticipate that we'll see some growth in spending over the life of the CBA beyond what's in the actual terms of the CBA because of the 2026 World Cup and trying to set up the league as best it can for that year going into the World Cup and coming out of the World Cup. And, you know, the owners are going to control that momentum. They're going to control how they best use it. And it'll be a while before the players are back at the table.
Hopefully, again, it'll be a while before they're back at the table. We will see if there are any future force majeure invocations, but I think we are all hoping that there will not be. Paul, one of the things that I wanted to talk about here a little bit is just kind of the overall dynamic. You know, there was a lot of talk this time that the players were going to stand their ground, right? They came out really strongly in December, even before force majeure was invoked. I believe it was before MLS Cup, and basically said invoking force majeure would be a huge mistake. You know, the league is running a big risk if it does it, like basically saying we're not happy. And if you do this, we're going to be more, even more unhappy. And at the end of the day, the league got the headline item it wanted and the players got the headline item they wanted to, right? I don't want to minimize that. And that's maintaining the pay for 2021. But they got what they wanted. And, you know, you and I both heard talk over the course of negotiations from different sources, basically being like, ah, the players, they're not going to go past 26, right? You said it on the show that you thought they would draw a line and that there would be a lockout. Obviously, it didn't end up that way. And it's just sort of, it's illustrative, right, of the kind of power dynamics at play here. MLS owners obviously have more leverage than the players. They make a lot more money. MLS players make more money now than they ever have before, but a lot of them still live month to month and can't afford to miss paychecks for potentially a lockout, maybe 3-4 months, maybe 1 month, who knows, right? They can't afford that. And that, I think, at the end of the day, is what drove this deal. And that's why we're here right now. And it's going to be really interesting to see. You know, we did like a quick headline thing on The Athletic in the wake of the news today. And one of the commenters on that piece was basically like, the full power of the union will never be realized until the union withholds its labor. And while I certainly don't begrudge the players from not withholding their labor, you know, this isn't my paycheck at stake, right? So more power to them for doing what they chose to do. That comment has a lot of truth to it. And I wonder if we're ever going to get to a point, or how long it will take for the players to withhold their labor. Any thoughts on that, Paul?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess the first thing I should say is that I mentioned to a couple different people on the weekend that I was a little bit embarrassed that I kind of bought into what we were hearing, you know, which is that the players were going to hold firm and that, you know, they were going to hold the line, and this was right, maybe the moment where we saw how, you know, how far the power of the players could go and what would happen when the owners were forced with a work stoppage and seeing the impact that can have on leagues. Work stoppages aren't good for the bottom line of owners. They, you know, the NHL took a long time to come back from its, what was it, a lockout or a strike. So, you know, clearly it's very difficult to get 700 plus players on the same page of what the best thing is to do. All of these players are coming from different backgrounds. Their lives in this league are all going to be on different timelines. And so when you're measuring the short-term gains and the long-term gains or losses, it's going to be difficult to get everybody to understand that, hey, sometimes you need to take a short-term pain in order to do something that's better for the players in the long haul, in the long run of things, and that it could be a generational change that occurs. But, you know, again, I think that the players have a very difficult decision to make. You know, more than a quarter of them in 2019 made less than $80,000 a year. Okay, so that's not like these guys are rolling in the dough. They've got mortgages. They've got rent. You know, they've got kids and wives. They've got families, bills that they got to worry about. And so when you start talking about losing four paychecks or six paychecks in the middle of a pandemic, you know, it gets scary. It's scary to think about what could happen. So I don't blame them, but I do agree with that commenter in that, you know, the power dynamic is what it is. I think partly because the owners don't believe that the players will ever hold firm, will ever strike, or in this case, hold the line and force a lockout.
Yeah. They certainly, I don't think, believe it yet. I think that's why they were comfortable threatening the lockout that they did, right? It was a good negotiating play at the end because it got them what they wanted. And I think that's the other part of this series. The league was really shrewd with what it offered the players, with how it presented it. That's something that we've been talking about here for, goodness, a month now. it's been a full month, Paul, over that, actually. So the league was really shrewd. You know, it's like, hey, here's this little carrot. You get to keep your salary in 2021, and then we'll hit you with the stick in 2026 and 2027 when, if we're being honest, most of the players in the union right now will not be in the league, right? So it won't affect them directly. And maybe some of them are looking out for the future generations, but a lot of them, you know, and again, I don't necessarily blame them for this. A lot of them are just worried about their own right now, which is totally fine. So shrewd offer from the league from a strategic standpoint, for sure. We talked about some of the other reasons with PR hits and lack thereof, potentially. But that the lockout threat was probably made. But to me, all of this had kind of a sense of inevitability about it. You know, there were some moments when I think both of us, it wasn't just you, I think both of us believed a little bit more that there could be a stoppage. But at the end of the day, this played out like a lot of other MLS labor negotiations have played out. I do think the union is a little bit stronger now than it was in the past, because I don't think if this was like 2015, right? In 2015, you were talking about it earlier with the discretionary money that came in afterward in the form of TAM. You know, that was when the union really got hurt, I think, right there in those negotiations. They got tamboozled, Paul.
Oh my God.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
On the fly, not bad.
I wish it was on the fly. I can't believe I haven't told that to you before, tamboozled. Anyway, I lost my train of thought. I do think that the give backs that they got were more than they would have gotten in like 2015, for instance. I don't think they got like completely walked over or anything in this, but the biggest item was the 2-year extension, and that one went to the league. And it's like we've been saying, it's illustrative of the power dynamic. So there's some news here I have. The league has confirmed the under 22 player initiative, Paul, officially. So Young Money is a thing. Sound
young
the alarms.
Money, baby. Money,
cash, sound money. The alarms, producer Taylor/Joe, whichever one of you is doing the show. and they've also released kind of the full info on player compensation for the new CBA. So there's a bunch of stuff on the league website at the moment that we'll have in our article on The Athletic as well. So please do go check that out. It's gonna be interesting. Like, now I'm sort of anticipating there being a decent number of significant player announcements now that this is all done. We talked about Cincinnati last show, but you know, it's kind of funny. Sao Paulo announced that move. Cincinnati, unless they have in the moment since we've started recording, have not yet announced that move. And it's just sort of like, well, you know, maybe they didn't want to do that for the optics. So I now that this is all sorted, I anticipate that there will be some more signings that follow. So that's going to be interesting. But I'm just looking at it now, and I'll give a couple of the headline numbers. Available spend on roster over the life of the CBA. In 2021, it's $9.225 million, and in the final year of the deal, it's $13.013 million. So an increase of less than $4 million over seven seasons. So really not that substantial. Now, there are ways to go above those numbers in terms of transfer fees and DPs and young money players. Also, so it's not like it's just limited, but you know that's kind of the ballpark we're dealing with here.
Well, we should also note that the revenue share plays an important part of any discussion about these 7 years. So once you get to 2024 or 2023, when the new TV deal kicks in, anything that's over $100 million of gain over the last CBA deal, I believe this is the way it's very confusing. But at that point, after you pass that $100 million mark, there will be a share of that revenue that the players will get a hold of. It's 12.5% for 2023 and 2024.
12.5% of every dollar over $100 million, I believe.
Right. Correct. And it used to be 25%. This is one place that the players gave money back to the owners over the course of the last two negotiations. And then it'll jump up to 25% in 25, 26, and 27. So the hope is that if they sign a big enough TV deal that you'll see, you know, potentially a couple million dollars added into the budget for players as well. But that is pending this media rights deal that the league still has to negotiate and sign. And, you know, we'd have to see substantial, really substantial increases to that deal for players to get a real cut of it. But it does factor in here. And I think, Sam, you know, the point holds, though, when you look at the gains over time, especially because they got pushed back, you know, no one's really wowing at the fact that in 2027, the total available roster spend will be $13 million, not counting discretionary funds used. Overall, not a very impressive number. The salary budget will be $7 million. GAM will be nearly $4 million. Discretionary TAM, $2 million. So, you know, we're not at the point yet where we're talking about real jumps pending that revenue share, no, pending
it's
that
incremental
media rights
growth.
Deal. It is still that incremental growth that the league loves so much.
Slow and steady maybe wins the race. I don't know. It at least keeps you running. That much we know from MLS's history and kind of the story of MLS over the years. But for the league to take the jumps it says it wants to take, I think they'll need to change this. And I think personally, they'll need to change the entire structure. Will that happen? Unlikely. But who knows? A lot of things are unlikely that end up happening. So maybe we'll be surprised at some point down the road. I'm not really going to hold my breath on that front, though.
Much more labor negotiation chat still to come from Paul and Sam, but first a word from today's sponsors. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Paul, I feel like we've been living in this CBA world forever, and my brain is totally fried on it. Is there anything that stands out to you as sort of flown under the radar, or even not under the radar, but like a big overarching point that's been lost by focusing on the micro so much?
Man, that's a heavy question. I think really what we see is just how far this league still has to go. You know, when we talk about the median salary of Major League Soccer players being $180,000 as of 2019, so we can say incrementally higher than that, but still under $200,000 most likely. When we talk about, you know, a salary cap of $7 million and a total all-in spend of $13 million, not counting DPs and in young money. It just shows still how much progress needs to be made in terms of investment, in players. I do think we'll see that start to change over the life of this CBA. But for me, when I step back, it just reminds me of how far, how much growth is still there for Major League Soccer and how far it needs to go to truly be competitive with a league like even League MX. You know, if we're going to talk about this league, you know, becoming a true player in global football as they want to do and being a real top 10 league as they've, you know, said that they want to be, you know, they need to become
top five. Paul.
Yeah, they need to be top five. They need to be the best in CONCACAF. And if they want to be the best in CONCACAF, when I look at this, you know, the amount of spending needs to go up, the quality of player needs to go up. And I'm not sure that the answer is in buying players who are 21 or younger or 22 and younger. I'm not sure if it's I get that it's not necessarily just increasing the salary budget and paying kind of middle of the road MLS guys more. But I think there need to be, as you said, some fundamental changes to how teams are able to build their rosters, the freedom with which they're able to build. And when I look over at the kind of the smaller points that these two sides are arguing over and fighting over and negotiating over, I'm like, man, these are little bullet points that just show me, you know, how much more yeah. we still have to go to seriously talk about Major League Soccer as influential in the sport that we cover.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I think the way the league is structured now, it protects the league from itself, protects the teams from themselves, but it also limits the ceiling. And just as importantly, in my opinion, it makes the money that it does, that the teams do spend, become inefficient, right? They're not getting as much bang for their buck as they could. They're not getting great value for the amount of money that they spend. And there's no real way to change that under the current structure because you have all these different buckets, right? TAM and GAM and DPs and young money and young designated players, and special discovery players, and, you know, waiver, God knows what else, you know, I'm forgetting a million of them, right?
Yeah. Homegrown TAM and
homegrown. You know. Yeah. And it's just like, if you just gave teams said, okay, you can spend this much money, $20 million. And you have to spend at least 10. And you can go over, like, you can have 2-3 players that don't count towards that, right? Or only the first X counts towards that. Then I think all of this could just be done a lot more efficiently. I understand the instinct from MLS, but I don't think they need to be in a place where they're protecting teams from themselves so much anymore. Let these people go out and take their risks, right? Let them go out and do what they want. And I think some teams will sink, right? But I don't think they'll get to the point where they're sinking all the way. And others, I think, will be able to swim that much faster. So hopefully we can get there one day.
And Sam, quickly, let's just look at the results of that. Within this really difficult to navigate system that really limits how you spend your money and where you spend your money, teams are already taking as much of the liberty as they can take to do things differently. You know, the way Philadelphia runs its business and FC Dallas runs its soccer business and the way Minnesota United runs it is totally different. And Minnesota United had a very good season focusing their spending on the first team. And Philadelphia had a very good season investing most of their money in the academy. And now Philadelphia has sold some players and they're going to take that GAM and they're going to be able to use more of it into their first team. And, you know, that hopefully will be something that it becomes kind of a self-perpetuating system, right? Same with FC Dallas. You know, Minnesota United, they're not going to have that opportunity, but, you know, they can keep taking that $2 or $3 million that would be, you know, in Philadelphia put into the academy, and they can say, no, we're going to use this as young money, or we're going to use this for another DP.
Right.
And, you know, now imagine that you take those restrictions off and you can build the entire business around however the heck you want to build it, right? And you don't need to worry about 3 DPs or, you know, X amount of TAM money that you've got left. And, you know, you can start to strategize across a number of years. And I just think that, again, we're seeing already MLS teams trying their best to run things as their own entities, the way that they want
to be distinct.
To do things.
And, yeah, to have an yeah, identity.
And to fit what the owner wants, to fit what the market dictates. And Jesse Marsh talked about it in your piece. Not every MLS team should have an academy if they don't want to have one. I would have fought that heavily 3 years ago if someone had said that to me. But I agree now. If Minnesota wants to send out their academy to all the local clubs and not spend the money there, fine. If Portland says, look, it's not worth it for us to spend $2 million a year on the academy, okay. As long as you're putting that money into the product and your teams are making a go at it, right? It's better than, you know, having these kind of budgets that make it seem like you're trying when you're not really trying. And
yeah, I mean, I would say it's maybe, depending on your point of view, it might even be better than what Dallas is doing, right? Where they put all this money into the academy, but they don't put it into the first team, and they have good academy results, and they win every national championship, and they sell academy kids to big European teams, and they have great outcomes in that way, but they don't actually win anything, you know? So, I don't know. It's all a matter of perspective. At the end of the day, I think increased kind of diversity, maybe is the word. Not in the traditional sense, but the more teams that have distinct identities, I think the better it will be for MLS. And I think the better it'll be for those clubs. I think fans like that stuff. I think they latch onto it, and I think they respond to it.
And Sam, I'm going to declare something right now, because if we are lucky enough, and it seems like we're lucky enough to be moving on from this being a labor
law. I was going to say, we stopped talking about podcast. The CBA a lot.
Yeah, so like this is no longer the foremost podcast on labor law.
Labor relations.
In soccer leagues in the United States. But I will tell you the thing I'm going to continue to harp on this year and every year until it's changed is the lack of transparency in Major League Soccer that still exists.
Yeah.
Of not just outside of Major League Soccer for the media and the fans to know how a team is spending its money and where, but internally, teams have no idea what the other teams are doing. And this is, by the way, this is not the way other professional sports leagues are run. There are internal systems in the other leagues where you can see what the average salary is for a player at X position at different ages, what another team's salary budget look like, how much space they have. Mm-hmm. And we as the public can go to SpotRack and we can see what an NFL team's budget looks like or what a Major League Baseball team looks like. And MLS is so far behind on it. And part of the reason they're behind on it is, frankly, look, unlike those leagues, MLS still has flexibility built into their rules, right? The league can help a team fix something in the middle of a year, can look the other way on a rule. It can. And fine, it does that for a reason. That's how it's always operated.
Paul, what are you saying? What kind of accusations are you making?
I'm just saying that's part of the reason they can't go public, because if the numbers don't add up and we ask a question about it, then they have
to
acknowledge.
If they go public, then they can't make stuff up on the fly.
Right, exactly. So there are, but that is such an important part of driving this league forward. You know, our conversations are limited to how we can talk about a team. When we talk about something like the identity of a team and how they spend, how they've used their allocation money, how they've used their TAM. You can't really evaluate an owner, a team, a GM, because you don't have the information. And it's so far behind the rest of the leagues in this country, and it limits the conversation around a league that shouldn't be limiting any conversation around it. The more conversation that we can have about MLS is better for MLS. They have to understand that.
Paul is just gesticulating wildly right now.
I am the hands angry are flying. About it. I'm fired up. I have something new to talk about on this podcast all the time besides CBA, and it's going to be transparency.
Oh, man.
This
we
is
did,
now
we
the
did
transparency
not plan
podcast.
Any of this.
No.
This is a transparency podcast brought to you by Peter Francis Geraci. on that note, I think we'll take a quick short break, and then we'll come back and finish up CBA talk forever, perhaps, and talk about a few other topics as well. We'll be right back.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Welcome back. Thanks for bearing with us there. One quick note on transparency that I wanted to add to Paul's impassioned plea for more transparency. You know, we were going over the CBA numbers earlier. Paul and I were going over them before we started recording and saying, oh, the budget is $7 million this year, $6 million, whatever. We're just going through the year by year. And I said, I think I said to you, Paul, I was like, this doesn't even matter because we don't even know how teams are using this stuff. So why do they even bother telling us? Like, who cares what the GAM breakdown is? It's just all guesswork. And in a sports world where the transaction is equal to or in some cases greater than the actual action on the field itself, the fact that MLS is inhibiting it, it's inhibiting that discussion is crazy. Hopefully they can move that forward. We'll see. I think, you know, you mentioned some of the reasons why. I think part of it is just like MLS doesn't have the staff that these other leagues do, and formalizing this and creating this database, it's a lot of work. And then making it public and making sure the public figures are accurate. Again, a lot of work. So, and I get why there are higher priority items that these people need to take care of. But hopefully we can sort of see a strategic shift there. And then you mentioned the other part. It's, you know, it allows them to shift on the fly. It allows people in the league office maybe to hold on to power, kind of control things as well, if they want to. So I think there are a lot of elements to play, but I think it would be really, it's a pretty easy thing. And it would be for the good of the league if they actually just increased it more.
Yeah, I mean, there are companies that do this for baseball that have contracts with baseball, with hockey, with NFL. You know, MLS doesn't need to hire that same company.
Should we crowdsource it?
But there are people, there are programmers who can build it, who can build their own system. It's not, anyways, that's not the point. We're not going to go into that right now. I do have a question for you, Sam. Now that this is no longer the foremost podcast on soccer labor relations.
I mean, we still are the foremost podcast on labor relations.
Have to talk about labor relations in any future podcast this year,
that title is in perpetuity. It remains forever, barring conditions of a force majeure clause being met.
Yes. Well,
of course.
Anyway, beyond now we are beyond the CBA talk in this episode, at least. Sam, what are you most looking forward to in 2021 for MLS?
Wow.
And not new who.
I was not looking forward to you stealing my question. Oh, there's Lyle shaking his head in the background, flapping his ears around. This is going to be a weird answer. FC Cincinnati. We talked to them about them a lot on the last show. Brenner coming in, that being official now. This is, I believe, the third biggest incoming transfer fee in Major League Soccer history. This is a massive, massive signing. And Gerard Nykamp and Jaap Stam, the GM and the head coach in Cincy, are really sticking their necks out here, right? And this is not all about, like, I think especially us on this show, we tend to frame transfer fees in the context of, are they going to be able to sell this player on, particularly when it's a young player? And are they going to be able to make profit? I don't think that's purely the move here for Cincinnati. I think that's a big part of it, but they're also opening a new stadium this year. They've also been dreadful for the last two seasons, absolutely miserable. So they need some more talent straight up. So I think there are a lot of different factors at play here beyond just resale value, but it's going to be really, really interesting. Making a move of this magnitude, it ratchets the pressure up on everyone. And I'm curious to see how this kid handles it, how the signing handles it. And I'm curious to see how Nykamp and Jaap Stam handle it. Not that they can't handle the pressure, right? But how the club handles it if there are some poor results, or if Brenner doesn't maybe get off to a hot start, what happens then? So I'm really interested in FC Cincinnati of all teams. And that is a sentence that, if you told me I was going to be saying like a week ago, I would have laughed in your face heartily. But here we are. Expect the unexpected. What about you, Paul? What are you most interested by?
I think what I'm most interested in is how teams use the young money. Every team is going to have a different approach to it. We're going to see some teams like Cincinnati taking full advantage of no limitations on transfer fees. We don't know if he'll be a young DP or young money, but the idea is the same. He's under 22 years old. You're spending a good amount of money. And I think if you look at the history of Major League Soccer, there are not a lot of players who are signed under the age of 22 who come in and have an effect right away. Certainly we've seen big money signings like Ezequiel Barco fail to live up to the expectation and the hype that gets put upon them. Look at Miami, two young players there who failed to live up to the expectation. And part of that is simply because of the reputation that comes with being a DP or for being a high money acquisition. And for a lot of these players, it's their first time leaving South America. I can't remember the name of the player. DC United had a young player a while back, a ways back. You know, it was his first time ever leaving his town. And he got on a plane and went to Washington, D.C. So
Chris Korb, I believe you're thinking.
Yeah, I don't think it was Chris Korb. So it's going to be, you know, I think it's a risk for Major League Soccer in that it's a lot harder to hit on these players. And I'm coming from a place where I've brought this up on this show before. I covered Orlando City in 2015. You know, they went and signed two young DPs right off the bat, Carlos Rivas and Brian Rochez. Those players were signed at a much lower money level than a Barco, for example, or even even a normal level DP. These were $1.5 million to $2 million investments. Carlos Rivas had 10 goals in the Colombian first division coming to Orlando City. There were high expectations around both of those players. And, you know, neither of them were able to meet that hype. And so I'm incredibly interested to see if targeting this spend on young players with the hope and the intention that these players are then sold on for more money is going to make things a little bit more difficult for these MLS teams to get out of their investment what they're putting into it. I hope that we see the level of the league go up and that we see a lot of good young players coming into MLS and that it's beneficial for the homegrown players who are training with better players and have more competition, that it's better for the product on the field. But I think it's going to be, you know, certainly in the first few transfer windows, a difficult road, and I'll be keeping an eye on kind of how it works.
Yeah, I think it'll be difficult the entire time just because of the age of these kids. Some are going to hit, some are not. And there's going to be a lot of money kind of thrown down the drain on speculative plays. And I think owners are really into the idea now, right? Because everyone you buy for 10, 13 million, well, you're going to sell him for 20, right? It's guaranteed profits. You're printing money. It's not going to work like that, right? So I'm curious to see what happens when there are misses and those start to stack up, if that really shapes maybe policy going forward and maybe they'll rejigger things again. I was trying to think while you were talking about young players coming to the league and booms and busts and guys that have hit, guys that haven't. I feel like Fabian Castillo is one of the success stories in this. And he came at the age of 19, and I don't have the stats in front of me, but it was FC Dallas 2011. I don't think he did a ton that first year, but I can't remember exactly. So even with some of these guys, you know, they're going to be quiet for a year, maybe two, and then maybe they'll burst onto the scene in year two or three. So it's going to be interesting. It's going to require some patience. But I think to our point earlier, it's going to increase the kind of distinct models that we see. And I think that'll be cool.
Yeah. I mean, how we talk about U22 players, it's going to be tough for the league to balance because you want to promote the spending. You want to promote the aggressiveness that's happening. We have people that we know and trust in the league who believes that this could be a real game changer, that this could be a really important...
Well, it could be if it's done right.
But you also have to preach caution, right? So it's like, on one hand, you want to publicize this big new spending venture. On the other hand, some of these players, to your point, are going to need time. Fabian Castillo had 2 goals and 3 assists in his first season with Dallas as an 18-year-old winger. Not bad, but it's not like he was what he was 4 years later when he had 10 goals and 4 assists. It took him some time to become the kind of Fabi Castillo that we think about when we talk about him in FC Dallas. And so, you know, there's going to have to be some of that understanding. And I think what bugs me about this pot of money is that, you know, you can still make money. I mean, Miguel Almirón was 23 going on 24 when he signed for Atlanta United, $8.5 million signing, and he was sold for much more than that to Newcastle. And, you know, he wasn't a bad investment at 23, 24, but Atlanta certainly knew more about him. They knew more of what they were going to get. He had played more professional seasons. He had produced more on that level. You know, even somebody like Barco, who was producing in Argentina.
Yeah, in huge games,
by the way, stepping up, taking a penalty kick in a final, a continental final. You know, that was one season that they saw what he could do. But it, sometimes you need to see more than that. And sometimes you need to factor in what it's like for a young player to have a lot of money and be in a different country. So all I'm saying is I'm excited. Again, I think it's a great thing that whenever MLS is spending more money, that's a positive. That's fantastic. Put the investment down. I just wish that it was in more places than just this one. And because of these reasons, I just think it's going to take some time for teams to learn how to invest this money, how to best invest it, and how to manage expectations around these players. And it's going to be different too, man. If you're a young player, like going to a team like FC Cincinnati, they don't have the time to not hype you up. They've got to put up right. Twitter posts with Brazilian steakhouse meat on it. Even if that Twitter post has to...
Brazilian steakhouse meat.
Even if that steakhouse meat has to hang on Twitter for 4 or 5 days before the official announcement, because it came in the middle of a CBA negotiation, you know, they don't have the time to say, hey, let's give this kid some time and some patience, let him adapt to the country. No, he's got to go and become the number nine and start scoring right away for FC Cincinnati. You know, he wouldn't have to do that if he was signing in Seattle, for example, because you have Rui Diaz there. So these are all just the different factors that are going to be at play with this new pot of money. It's super intriguing. It's super interesting. It's going to be a lot of fun to watch and keep track of and to write about. I think it's going to be, you know, the main thing that we talk about as far as incoming players into MLS for the next 3 or 4 transfer windows, at least.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be fascinating to follow. Also going to be fascinating to follow. And, you know, I think we can and maybe close out the show on this note. Inter Miami linked with Ryan Shawcross, 33-year-old defender from Stoke City. I think, you know, I think we called this on a previous show that Inter Miami was just going to be going after like older League One and Championship players and bringing them over on decent sized contracts. And that's what they were going to build their MLS team around. Maybe we spoke that into existence. So we'll see if they get this Shawcross deal across the line.
You hold the, first of all, the best headline was that it was like Inter Miami going to sign ex England captain. And then it was Shawcross.
Is that better or worse than when Aaron Long is referred to in the British press as USA captain?
It's the same thing. It's the same thing. It's not better or worse. It's the same.
I would say it's worse.
Yeah. So look, I think that he'll be held to the standard, a very high standard of Liam Ridgewell in his first few years in Portland. Liam Ridgewell was 3 years younger when he came to Portland, I'll note, and he came as a designated player. But he had
was immediately made
MLS,
an All-Star,
so,
by the way.
You know.
I think the All-Star game was his first MLS game, maybe. Commissioner's pick.
Yeah, so we'll see. But certainly I'm interested to watch the road Miami will now travel under the direction of Phil Neville and David Beckham. And Chris Henderson. You know, maybe Chris Henderson has some other moves up his sleeve to go along with Ryan Shawcross. We'll see.
Yeah, I think he's going for Jolyon Lescott and Andy Carroll. That's what sources tell me. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to Allocation Disorder, formerly the world's foremost labor relations podcast. Well, not formerly, in perpetuity, but we won't talk about that ever again. Thanks for bearing with us through these CBA talks. We know they're not the most exciting things. We're excited to get back to kind of our bread and butter and talk more about MLS and roster building and in a couple of months, what's happening on the field. So thank you so much for listening. I'm Sam Staiskel. He's Paul Tenorio. This has been Allocation Disorder.